Thank you for being here. I know some of you were here last time, and I appreciate you coming back considering what I said last time. Probably, I can't remember what words I used, but they were probably highly inappropriate. But so I'll tell you, I do a lot of teaching. That's my job. I work down at DTS. And I'll be honest, you guys are the most anxiety-provoking group for me to speak to because you're my peers. And you get to see me parent. Down at the seminary, it's just a bunch of people who never get to witness me parent, and so they think I'm good at this. And I'm just building this ship as I sail it, so we are. So I'll just be honest, you guys are kind of my toughest crowd because we will probably drag a screaming child out of the church today, just knowing how this is going. It's always those days that you talk on parenting that one just loses it. So if you hear screaming, it's probably our family. Okay, so one of my other roles is I train counselors down at DTS. And so one of the things that we really work hard to do is to help them not be shocked by things. So when their client drops a big bomb on them, they're not like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened to you. Ugh. Because we don't want them to produce shame in their clients. And so I work really hard to shock them so that they won't be shocked when they work with clients. So I'll probably shock you today and hopefully help you start the uncomfortable conversation so that when your kid drops a bomb on you, you're not shocked by them. And inwardly, you may be like, oh God, okay, okay, deep breaths, I can do this. But we want you to be calm and cool and collected. Okay, so this week is birth to elementary. I'm gonna set the stage from little bitty to the midstream, and then next week I'll carry on up to the end of adolescence. God help us all. So, okay, one of the things I wanna challenge you to do, if you haven't already, is to really think about where do you want your daughter to end up, okay? And maybe not necessarily only like, okay, so we want her to marry a nice guy, and I hope she gets at least a master's, and maybe she'll have like a nice house in the DFW area. Not necessarily that. I want you to think about her character and her heart. Who do you want her to be when you are done with her? Okay, and that's the goal, that you will launch her. Like the whole goal is that they leave. That was the point of the talk, that we're not raising girls, we are raising women, okay? And so this week, I would encourage you, if your spouse is participating in this with you, to just ask that question. What do you want your girl to be like? What is the end goal, okay? Reason being is we tend to be more reactive than proactive. And so it's like, oh gosh, okay, well, we just gotta roll with this and this happened, rather than how are we gonna prepare for what's coming, okay? Those of you who are on the early end of this, you kind of get a advantage to some of us because you're not midstream, you're starting out early. But if you are midstream, that's okay. So ask your spouse, ask yourself, where do you want your kid to be? Also, I want to encourage you that culture is going to inform how you parent. So scripture tells us you want to be in the world, but not of it. But with that, we have to be good stewards of what the world, how the world shapes our kid and how it's informing our child. And so because of today's culture, we live in a highly sexualized, kind of overly explicit world now where information is readily available to all people. Like when we were kids, we had to, did anybody have the World Book encyclopedias at their house? Yes. And that's how you did book reports. My parents still have them. I'm like, I think we could get rid of these from 1980. But it was, you had to search for information. Now it's always at your fingertips. And so you've got to be ahead of the curve and know that you have to parent in light of all of this information that's coming at your daughter. Okay, we'll talk more about that in a second. Also too, talk about everything. If you create an atmosphere where she knows she can come to you, then you are more likely to be the one that gets to help her through the hard stuff. And so get comfortable with the really uncomfortable things. So we're gonna do an exercise and everybody's gonna blush. I'm even blushing a little bit. So I want everybody to say the word vagina with me. Loud, own it. Vagina! Okay, great. Okay, do that at home. Talk about those things that make you so uncomfortable. Here's the thing. Kids will not talk about or do things with you that they intuitively know you're uncomfortable with. And they just naturally know it. So my specialty is play therapy, which means I work mostly with kids and adolescents. And in that, I usually don't allow parents to be in my counseling sessions. That's kind of the gold standard to play therapy. Reason being is because kids won't go there and play out what's going on if their parents are present because they know they're uncomfortable with it. And so if you can work on being as comfortable as possible with really uncomfortable topics, then they are far more likely to come to you. And if you are uncomfortable, it's okay to say, so this kind of makes me blush a little bit, but I want you to know it's okay to talk to me about these things. Sometimes I get a little nervous. That is far better than your kid trying to guess why you're acting weird. Okay, so talk about the really uncomfortable stuff. And then next, one of the things that is really an issue right now for girls in our culture, research shows that as women, we have far more opportunities and far more advantages than we've ever had. Unfortunately, as women, we are taking far more antidepressants and far more anti-anxiety meds. Now, I'm pro-meds. If they're needed, it's important and they should be taken. But that signals that something's going on in our world, if that's happening. And so research has showed that we are far more disconnected from one another. And we know as believers that connection and relationship is what we were created for, and it's the most important part of our lives. Okay. In scripture, if you look at Genesis, prior to the fall, prior to everything getting messed up, what did God say about Adam before he created Eve? Anybody know?
He needed a helper.
He needed a helper. It wasn't good for him to be alone. And so we know prior to things getting messed up, God created us for connection. We are hardwired to be in relationship with others. Unfortunately, we're far more disconnected now than we've ever been. And we long for connection. And we think we're connected because we're tweeting and posting and hashtagging or whatever. And we feel like we're connecting with people. That's not true relational connection the way we were created to be. That's okay. That's good. That's part of our times. And we want to embrace that. It's helpful. But it's not meeting that need. And so that's one of the reasons they're speculating girls are far more depressed, is because we are not truly in relationship with others. And so one of your main jobs is going to be to work to help her be connected in a truly authentic manner. Now, one of the main guys in play therapy, one of his, he calls them rules of thumb. He says, you can't give away that which you don't possess. Okay. So if you're not authentically connected, it's going to be really hard for you to give that away to your daughter. And so I would highly encourage you guys to work on authentic connection in a way that trickles down into the rest of your family and impacts your daughter in amazing ways, okay? So I'm gonna cover a foundation thing. I love talking about the brain. It's like my favorite thing. And then I'm gonna talk about some of the themes I'm gonna cover that I think are really important for women. Okay, so the brain. At birth, your brain is made up of about 100 billion neurons, or brain cells. Those are the same terms. Neurons and brain cells mean the same thing. And what happens is throughout life, the brain, especially in early childhood, it's going to continue to make what we call connections. And every time you have an experience, those neurons are connecting with one another. Okay? And part of it is genetically influenced, but a large part of it is experiential. Okay? So every time, like today, your neurons are firing. As you're sitting here listening to me, you're making connections. Okay, so that's what's happening at birth all the way through the rest of the life, but it's huge in the first couple years of life, okay? And the brain is gonna lay some very foundational, what we will call ruts, in the brain based off of these experiences. And it follows what's called Hebb's axiom. Hebb's axiom is neurons that fire together are going to wire together. So the more you have a repeated experience coupled with something else, the more likely those two things are to wire together. So what this looks like, if I, like with my little girl, we have a little one, she's five. And if I, this is a great example. So she has a lovey, we're a blanket family. Those are what my kids have been drawn to, not stuffed animals, but blankets. And so we call them BBs, they're both called BB. Because we're super creative, and hers is brown blanket and his is blue blanket. So, yeah, we're amazing. So BB is really special to her. And BB was given to her before she was born. And we used to, it's a pretty large, it's not like an actual baby blanket size, it's a pretty good size. And we would wrap her up in it, and we would hold her close. And so what's happened now is that her experience of BB has now been tied with the experience of my husband Chad or of me holding her close. And because we've done that over and over and over again, and because it brings comfort, BB and us, she has in her brain, BB and comfort have now been wired together. And so Chad and I don't even have to be present for her to feel comfort if BB's present. Okay. The other day she was like, I wish I could take BB to school. It's like, I know, sweet girl. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm not going to let you do that. Because they're going to make fun of you and I'm going to protect you in that way. But she wants that comfort during her school day. Okay. So that's how it gets wired together. Also, what happens is we develop what's called neural nets. And this over the lifespan happens. But it's kind of like you can have several different experiences tied into the same pathway, if that makes sense. And so it can only take one tug on one part of that net. If you think the net has, let me just draw a diagram. So if you think this is the net, however a net would be, and each of these represents a part of the experience, you only have to tug on one part of the net for the whole thing to fall down, okay? And what that looks like, if it's a positive experience, that's great. Like if it's BB and she's by herself, like we have a babysitter or something and she's scared and she holds BB close, well, that can pull down the neural net of mom, dad, BB comfort, okay? If it's a bad experience, so I never knew how anal I was until I had kids. And as they got older, I was like, wow, I really need to work on this. And so it's just my natural default position that when she spills something or he spills something, I'm like, what does that tell her? You're annoying me. I can't believe you just did that. What is wrong with you? Okay. And so I'm working on this, but I've done this so many times now that sweet girl, every time it happens, she's like, I'm so sorry. Okay. And so it tugs the neural net of shame down. Okay. So you can have those positive neural nets or the negative neural nets. Okay. Also, there's different sides of the brain. This is just kind of a rough and dirty quick explanation of the brain. But the right side of the brain is the part of the brain that's really online at birth. And it's responsible for picking up on sensations and nonverbals and everything involved with not language. Okay. And so that's birth to 24 months. And so what happens is the right side of the brain is taking in all of these experiences during those first 24 months and it's encoding it. And so if your daughter has an experience where her needs are met in a timely manner most of the time and she feels safe and warm and soothed, then the right side of the brain is going to encode that. It's also going to encode all of your nonverbal language. Okay? So what's happening is she will not have conscious recollection of this. So she will not have memories that she can recall, like what I had for breakfast this morning. That's a conscious recollection. But she will have what we call body memories and sensations. And so even though she can't go back and remember at 18 months what happened, her body and her sensations and her right brain remember that. The left side of the brain comes online about 18 to 24 months, and it's responsible more for what we call explicit memory, conscious recall. And it's responsible for language and everything linear, logical, and the why question. That's why at about two years of age, when girls start asking why repeatedly, it's a great sign, even though it's crazy annoying as a parent. It's like, I don't know why. It just happens, okay? That's a great sign because it means they're cognitively developing the way that they're supposed to, okay? So as these things develop, they're gonna form ruts in her brain and neural nets. And if the experiences are positive, then it's gonna form more of that kind of positive experience in her brain versus negative. So with that, relationships are highly influenceable of this. So how you interact with your daughter in these first 24 to 48 months is gonna influence how her brain forms. Now, some of you are panicking at this point because you're like, I didn't do a good job, I shamed her. You just have to be good enough most of the time. Like, that's what the research says. You just have to be a good enough parent most of the time. So if you can just aim for mediocrity, you are winning, okay? Just keep reminding yourself, all I need to be is mediocre. Does anybody watch Jimmy Fallon? Did y'all see they just, yeah, okay. one of Swindoll's books was on there. It was like living above mediocrity, and I'm like, not in parenting. Okay, sorry. I just think it's funny. Okay, so you just have to be good enough most of the time. And you're going to knock it out of the park sometimes. Just the fact that you guys are here shows that you really care about your kid. And you're probably the parents who are doing a whole lot right. But you are human, and you're sinful, and so you're going to drop the ball. And you're going to have times where you like, wow, I don't know what's wrong with me. Okay, so in that moment, the most important thing I can impart to you. So if you're going to like surf Amazon, that's awesome. That doesn't offend me at all. I tell my students out at DTS, I don't care what you look at on your computer while I'm speaking. This is your $1,500 you're spending. Just don't disturb your neighbor. So I don't care what you look at. But if you hear one thing from me at all today, I want you to hear what's most important in parenting is repair. Okay? Repair is the most important thing you can do in all of parenting, I believe. Reason being is whenever you do fumble the ball, what happens with the left side of the brain, because it's very logical and linear, it wants to make sense of things. And so as a parent, when we have a bad day and I, you know, am harsh with my girl or our boy, and I say something like, could you just hurry up? What's gonna happen is her brain wants to seek to make sense of that. And what it will do, kids are really great observers and really poor interpreters. And so what she'll probably do is she'll own that rather than being like, mom's having a bad day and she's busy and she's stressed out. And it's not about me, it's about her. She just needs a little more therapy with Mary. That's not where she'll go. She's gonna go to, there's something probably inherently wrong with me, okay? We tend to internalize those things. And so whenever we leave that loop open as parents and we, you know, flip our lid or whatever, that leaves a question mark for our kid that their brain has to make sense of and come back to. And so if you can close that loop and do what we call repair, that is the most important thing you can do as a parent. And what that looks like is whenever you realize you've messed up, you come to your child and you say you're sorry and you own your behavior and you ask for forgiveness, okay? And that's one of the most important things. All healthy relationships are characterized by repair, all of them. In marriage, in work, in parenting, everything. So what that looks like, and I tend to have to apologize to my daughter the most, I'm not really sure why she's my identified victim, but she is. And so what that looks like is I say, sweet girl, mommy had a hard day, and I overreacted and I was harsh with you. Would you please forgive me? That wasn't about you, that was mommy stuff. Okay, that's not Emmy stuff, that's mommy stuff. So at least she knows this isn't me. She may grow up thinking, mom is totally messed up, and all therapists are crazy, but at least she won't own that, okay? So repair is most important. So moving on, I'm going to talk through infancy and elementary, and I'm going to touch on four themes. The first one is spiritual development. The second one is relational development, boundaries, and independence. Okay. So in infancy, the relationship and the spiritual development are absolutely foundational. Okay. This is like when you build a house, and I'm getting way, way out of my lane of expertise here. But I would think that you need to lay a really good foundation, which I guess is apparently really difficult here in North Texas because the soil sucks. So ideally, you would lay a good foundation. Scripture talks about this. The house that's going to stand is the one that's built on rock as opposed to the one that's built on sand. Okay, so this is that foundation. So there is a guy who theorizes that our viewpoint of God is seen directly through the lens of how we experienced our parents. Okay, our viewpoint of God is seen exactly through the lens of how we experienced our parents. And if you want to hear more about that, he'll be here in March at a conference here at Stonebriar. So look for that. His name is Kurt Thompson. So how your kids experience you is how they will be able to experience their Heavenly Father. Okay, so think about that in your own life. Think about how you experience God. Is he trustworthy? Is he someone who's safe? Now, I know all the theological answers, okay? I have great theology. I went to DTS, and I teach there, so I have to have good theology. But practically, some of those things are hard for me to get on board with because of my early experiences. And that may be true of many of you, okay? And so, as a parent, you you want to lay this foundation that they will see God for who he truly is. He's safe. He soothes. He accepts you even when you're broken, before you're broken, actually. Okay? And so that's the foundation you want to lay in the early years. Also, with relationship, I already touched on this. We were created for relationship. So apart from it, we will wither. As a counselor, one of the things I really want to know is what kind of social support system do you have? My clients who have very little social support system concern me the most because I know they don't have what they need, what God says we need. Okay. And then the big word for this is what we call attachment in psychology. So in those first couple of years of life, that's the thing that's huge that's forming. How are you attaching to your main caregivers? And basically attachment is, it is a special relationship that is different than all other relationships. And the key markers of attachment is being seen, being safe, being soothed, and being secure, okay? So you as the parent see them. And sometimes that's hard. Technology kind of makes this a lot harder for us. Because how many times, like I do this all the time, that we've got a down moment and I'm checking my phone. Okay, I'm not probably seeing them. Okay. Safe, they feel safe with me psychologically, emotionally, physically, that they know that I'm gonna protect them or my husband's going to protect them. Soothed, when they're hurt, you soothe them. Okay, we see this really interesting thing in attachment and development where it's almost like the baby brain borrows the adult brain. So while the relationship is going on and the baby can't soothe themselves, but the adult soothes them because they have what we call a regulated, more mature system, it's almost like the baby gets to piggyback off of that and borrow it until they can do it on their own. Now, some of you don't have babies, and you're like, okay, well, we missed the boat about this. We should have another one, and we'll start over. Just kidding. Don't do that. You can start with this at any point. Any point, even if your child is an adult, okay? At any point, you can start having a good attachment with them. It may be a little more challenging to develop this, but at any time, you can do it, okay? So that's kind of the key points of attachment. Also, there can be multiple attachments, and hopefully there are. Hopefully mom and dad are securely attached. You may have some people that are special in your world to your child that are also securely attached. Grandparents, we have a couple of different nannies we've worked with, and I see them. I think our kids have a special attachment to them that they don't have with other people just because they've been a part of their lives. So it's not just relegated just to one parent. Okay, so with boundaries and protection, obviously there's physical protection. I'm not gonna talk about that. You can manage that with your kids. But I think it starts in the early years where you start putting up boundaries around your family system and boundaries around your marriage. So another thing, if you just want to help your kids, just work on your marriage. Most of the time, I have clients referred to me because the marriage is a problem. The kid's acting out and they're showing lots of signs of issues, but I can see that it's a marriage issue. If parents would work on their marriage, it will solve a lot of the problems for the kids. So I'll give a plug, because my husband and I love Marriage Corps and are very involved in it. We have a ministry here every Tuesday night. It's from 6:30 to 8:15 called Marriage Corps. It's free. There's free childcare. If nothing else, it's just a free date. Like you can come and sit and we'll watch. I won't personally watch your kids. Because I love working with kids, but I don't love working in the nursery. So someone who is well-trained will watch your children and you can come and just work on your marriage. Okay. If nothing else, we have good cake. So you can just come eat our cake and just have a date, okay? So also with this is you getting your priorities right, okay? Right now, especially in North Texas culturally, what do we hear about kids in reference to the family? Anybody know? They're the most important. They should be the center of our universe. That's not true, and it's not biblical, okay? There are a lot of things that I'll say, oh, it's what's best for your family. This is what I believe is best for the family. When your kids become the center of your universe and the center of your world, you are putting far too much pressure on them, and it's too much for a little one to bear. And so they need to know that they are not the end-all, be-all of your world. Also, it'll be really good for them when they go to college and your marriage doesn't fall apart because you've been focusing on them too much, okay? So, from my perspective theologically, I believe that there is an ordering to your family priorities. I believe that God is first, then your spouse, and the reason your spouse comes second is because that is what we call a covenant. And a covenant is a different kind of relationship. God made a covenant with us, and he allows married partners to make a covenant with one another. There is no covenantal relationship between parent and child. And so the marriage trumps the kids every time, okay? And then kids, and then whatever else you want to put on there, okay? If you order your life the way God intended it to, it's not going to be easy. Life is always going to be hard. I don't want to sell you some, like, parenting prosperity gospel, because there is none. But it will make some things work a little bit easier. Okay? So order your priorities correctly and get her out of the main spotlight. She does not need to be the center of your universe. Also, the world is going to continue to tell her that she's most important. We live very much in a me-centric culture, and so you just don't want to feed into that any more than you can. Okay? All right. So with preschool going on, this is where spiritual development is really going to take a lot of shape. It's always helpful to start when they're babies, because even though they may not consciously have recollection of this because their explicit memories haven't started forming yet, it gets you in the habit. But in preschool, it's so important to use what we would call concrete Bible stories. And our church, Dave leads an incredible team. And they really make it very, very easy just to kind of paint by number. If you just do what they tell you to do, you've done a whole lot. And you bring them here on a regular basis, they're doing a lot of the work for you. But we want to do concrete Bible stories because they don't think what we would call abstractly. And abstract thinking is where you can think in the gray of the world, okay? So concrete thinkers can't think in the gray. An example of this is with, like, moral development. So if you ask little kids below adolescence, maybe a little later, would it be right for you to steal a drug that you can't afford but it will save your mom's life, or is it right to let her die and not steal? They will always answer, it's right to not steal. That's concrete thinking. Whereas when you get beyond that, you can reason and say, well, life is more important than this rule. Okay. Another example of this. So my son, oh dear, he has a lot of pathways crossed. But I guess I always pray when I pray for them at night when I put them to bed. And Lord, please let them trust you for salvation. I guess I like to pray like my DTS prayer, I guess. And one night he goes, so Mom, if I say salvation and trust Christ, then I'll die on the cross like Big Ginger. I'm like, so let me fill you in on this. Big Ginger is my grandmother who died in January, and they were part of that. They got to go to the funeral. And I was like, wow, you are way off, buddy. Okay. One, Big Ginger didn't die on the cross. And you don't have to die on the cross. And so I realized how abstract these terms were and how he had kind of crossed all these lines in his little brain. Okay, so you got to be really concrete. And that gave us an opportunity to clear things up. And I changed how I prayed for him at night. Lord, please let Will believe that you died for his sins. Or his misbehavior. I like to use the word misbehavior because sin's like, now what does sin mean? Okay, so concrete and then repetition. Over and over and over again. Even if it's the same Bible story, just over and over and over. Again, coming to church, if you stay for both services, they get a lot of repetition. That's awesome. It's like double the helping, okay? So just do it over and over. Relationally, so attachment is going to continue through this phase, that you continue to see them, you soothe them, you're safe, and they feel secured with you. Also, at this place, we want to start naming emotions. So kids, people, humanity, we're not born with the intuitive sense of this is what an emotion looks like or feels like or this is what the name is for it. Okay, we are all ingrained by God with the capacity to feel. That's one of the communicable attributes we share with him as image bearers. But that doesn't mean we're good at it. Okay, and so if you can begin to name their emotions, one, it helps them understand, oh, okay, this is what it feels like when I'm mad. Now, that's probably not what they're going to consciously say to you, so just prepare your heart. It may be something like, I hate you, you're the worst mom ever, but it's helping them. Also, your brain does this interesting thing that we have these things called mirror neurons. And as we witness someone do something, our brain prepares, those neurons prepare to do the same thing. And so when my kid, when he gets really mad or she gets really mad, and I say, Emerson, I know you're really mad at me right now and you're not happy with what's happening. What that is doing is that, one, I'm showing her empathy. When I name her emotions, I'm showing her empathy. And so her little brain is preparing to do the same thing. And so it prepares them neurologically to be able to do what you're doing as an adult as you go forward in their world. Okay. Also, there's some theorists that think, particularly one, his name is Dan Siegel. I've listed a lot of his books on the references, that you can name it to tame it. And there is some evidence that shows, it doesn't happen all the time, but when you just name their emotion and see them, it helps calm them, okay? When someone is like, I know you're really angry, this is a really crappy situation, it's kind of like, yeah, I am. And so it just is kind of soothing. So name it to tame it to help them, one, learn emotions, and then to help them figure out how to manage that going forward. Also, making amends, I talked about this. The biggest thing you can do is say you're sorry and ask for forgiveness. Okay? It shows that, one, it's okay to ask for forgiveness, and adults make mistakes. Okay? You don't want them to grow up and think adults are never wrong, because if you have an adult that tries to hurt your kid, you want them to know that it's okay for adults to be wrong. Also, it teaches them how to do it. Okay, friendships are really important in the preschool years. This is where kids developmentally first start to be able to actually do mutual social play. Up until this point, kids will do what we call side-by-side play. If you go down to the nursery and peek in, which you're actually not allowed to do, so don't do that. But imagine that you could, and you see like 18-month-olds. They really don't do collaborative play. They're not at that place developmentally. But at this point, they'll start to do that, okay? Also, there's huge amounts of brain growth happening, and there's lots of connections being made, and so there is going to be high emotionality, okay? I want you to think about a 3-4-year-old and compare them to like a 11 to 13-year-old. They kind of look the same. I mean, physically, they're different, but emotionally, they seem a lot alike. What's happening during those two phases is the brain is having a huge explosion of growth with the neurons. They're making more and more connections during those two times than they do throughout the rest of life. And so that causes them to be slightly emotionally unstable. If you can just remind yourself in that moment, this is normal, this is normal. Andy said it's normal, it's okay. Breathe, she's not crazy, okay? Boundaries and protection. So you set the stage for boundaries, and you are teaching her how she should allow the world to relate to her, okay? So with this, first of it is sexual. And did anybody go to Back to Basics last week? Was it last week? Oh, the week before last, sorry. That was amazing. She did a great job and gave a lot of great information. So I'm not going to cover a lot because she already did that. But during this phase of time, you're going to talk a lot about good touch, bad touch. This is your body, and your body is yours. And your vagina is not for anybody else to touch but you by yourself in your room. That's the phrase we give. You use anatomically correct terms always. This is so uncomfortable. I know it is. And it's really uncomfortable when your kid like is screaming it in the parking lot. They'll stop. It'll lose it. Will was dropping penis on the way into church today, which I'm just glad it wasn't a cuss word because that's happened too. It's like, oh, well, it's that or something else. But the reason you want to do this, it's not to push the envelope, it's not to be uncomfortable, it's to protect them. This is a boundary issue. One of the reasons is because sometimes kids will make an outcry, and if you use some cutesy little term, nobody knows that they're being molested, okay? Debbie Wade told a story about a little girl who they called it her cookies. And so she kept telling the teacher, they keep touching my cookies. And so she was like, okay, I'll tell them to stop touching your cookies. What she meant was they're touching my vagina. But no one could help her because no one knew what she was saying. Also, when it comes to prosecuting sexual offenders, they need you to use anatomically correct terms. so that that holds up well, okay? So it's not, I know I'm kind of like to be edgy and push the envelope and make people uncomfortable, but it really is about protecting my daughter Emerson. I'm not with her all the time. She's with other people a lot. And I want to give her the best opportunity to stay safe as possible, okay? Also talking about privacy during this time. So it's bathroom time, so there's privacy, okay? And so you talk about privacy for her and privacy for others in the family. Technology, this is not, I heard someone say recently that every generation has always said times are much harder to parent, but it really hasn't actually been true until now. It is much harder to parent now because there are a lot more uncontrollable factors that you have to take into account. With things like bullying and pornography, it used to be that that was all outside the home and you can control the boundaries of your house. Now we bring it into our home. You know, it used to be if you wanted to buy porn, you had to go to 7-Eleven and have the walk of shame. But now you can get it at a moment's notice. Okay, and so you've got to start now setting up those boundaries. Debbie Wade gave a startling statistic that most first-time exposures now to porn, I think she said was like at 6 or 7. Okay. 6 or 7 is first grade. Okay, just let that sink in. So you need to be very proactive with that so that it's not accidental exposure. And then she encouraged as well that you talk to your kids about what to do when it happens. Your friends might show you something and you want to look away. I know it's interesting and you're curious, but it's really not good for you. It's not good for your brain, okay? I'm sure they're like, my brain, what? Okay, independence. The whole goal is that they leave, okay? Not the whole goal. You want them to leave well and with some important things, but ideally, none of us want our kids living with us when they're 45, okay? If you do, I would love to give you a referral today. And you can work on that. But with that, it starts young. Being able to be independent, it's like a muscle. And if you exercise it regularly, it will be stronger. If you never have the opportunity to exercise that muscle, it will never grow. And so we want to start really little. And what Gary Landreth, the big play therapy guy, would say with big choices for big kids and little choices for little kids. And so with my daughter right now, I can say, depends on where we're going and how important it is to my emotional development and well-being that she matches. So it just depends. But like yesterday before breakfast, I could say, go get your clothes on, okay? And she might say, well, what do I wear? And I'm like, it's up to you. You can pick that. That's a choice she can do. I can't tell that to my 3-year-old. He's just not capable yet. With her, I might say, do you choose to have the donut backpack or the purple backpack? But I would never say, do you choose to go to private school or public school? That is a too big choice for her, okay? So big choices for big kids, little choices for little kids. And ideally, as they begin to exercise this choice giving, and you can use what we call choice giving language in play therapy, it's if you choose this, then you choose this. This is kind of what we do with consequences. If you choose to hit me, you choose to go to timeout. And what I want to do for her in her brain is I want to tie your behavior has a consequence. I'm not choosing either one. It's totally up to you. I'm okay with what you choose. Just know there's consequences to whatever there is. And what that builds is what we call an internal locus of control. Now, an internal locus of control is where you can be self-directing and self-disciplined. An external locus of control is where you need people from the outside to guide you and tell you what's right or wrong. The reason we don't want an external locus of control is when they go to college and they totally lose it and freak out and sleep with everything that walks, okay? Or drink whatever's offered to them, okay? So we want to build that along so that they can do what's called role-playing consequences. Okay, if I choose this, then this will happen. Or if I choose this, then this will happen. It has to be built. Again, if you're not starting from little bitties, that's okay. Start now. You can always start now. That's the beauty of parenting. God is redemptive, and He allows for a lot of growth to occur, even if it doesn't occur at the very beginning. Okay. So young elementary, spiritual development, still very concrete. They are not abstract thinkers at this point yet. Also, repetition. Lots of questions. So a lot of times we give information to kids, but we never ask to see if they know what's actually going on. With our son, he always answers, yes, I know what that is, because I'll be like, such and such and such and such. And I'm like, do you know what that is? Yes. And if I just went on, I would have never clarified. He never knows what he's talking about, ever. He's such a poor historian and poor report. He'll be like, I don't know. So always ask, well, do you know what that is? Can you tell it to me? Tell me what it is. So ask them lots of questions. Ask them what they think. Well, what do you think about this? What do you think about Daniel in the lion's den? What do you think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being in the flames? What do you think that would have felt like for you, other than hot? Ask them questions, okay? This may become really, really important for us, because we've lived in a nation for a long time where it's been very easy. That may not be so for very much longer. I don't know. I just know that, like, when Chuck gets serious, I need to listen and panic. So he's very serious about it. And so is the president down at DTS. I'm like, oh no, is this the time to panic? It's not the time to panic. It's just the time to be wise with how we're raising our kids. Okay, provide opportunities. So with spiritual development, there are lots of opportunities here to get involved. There's also lots of opportunities in other parts of the city for spiritual development. Maybe you don't live right here in Frisco. We have a lot of friends that live down in Plano, and maybe they pick an Awanas that's on a day of the week that works better for their schedule, that's closer to their house. That's great. You don't have to just drink the Jesus Kool-Aid offered here. You can drink the Jesus Kool-Aid at other places too. I'm sorry, that's a very inappropriate reference. Sorry about that. Okay. Friendships are increasingly more a big deal. Just think, friendships are gonna get more and more important as they age, and you will feel less and less important. It's not that you are less and less important. You are absolutely crucial to all stages, but friendships are gonna be really, really important going forward, and increasingly so. We'll talk more about it next week, but their drive for being in relationship with others is good because it helps them wanna leave you and be more independent, okay? So providing opportunities for this. Now you're gonna have to be more intentional that you provide more authentic relational opportunities. Okay, if you think about, we went and visited some friends last week in Wisconsin, and we don't have a whole lot of kids on our block, but we would never let our kids just run across the street. And at one point I look up and I'm like, Molly, do you know where our children are? She's like, oh yeah, they're at the neighbors. I was like, huh. She was like, they're totally safe. We love them. And the whole time we were there, they ran back and forth across the street and played with the neighbors. Of course, they live in like small town America, Safeville, but we don't have that up here, I don't feel like. And so we have to be more intentional to create those types of relational opportunities where they connect one-on-one. And it's not, hey, we texted or we're chatting online. So we just have to be more proactive. Remember, that is one of the things that will safeguard them in the future against depression and anxiety, is that they are authentically connected to other people. Okay. Now, if you're an introvert, and when I say introvert, I mean your battery gets recharged by being alone. That is me. Like, if someone was like, we're going to drop you off in the forest and we'll come get you in 6 days. It's like, as long as there's a cabin and running water, I'm fine. And if I can blow dry my hair, that's great too. That's great. I was like, can I do that once a month? I'm way introverted. So I recharge by myself, and I would think that was amazing. So it's sometimes harder for me because I don't want to spend time with people on my downtime, but I know it's important to my very extroverted child at times, okay, and my extroverted husband. Okay, relationally as well, dads, you are so crucial. And there's a great book called Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters by Dr. Meg Meeker, and she talks about how your role is irreplaceable in the life of your daughter. And sometimes I've heard dads report that when your little girl gets to a certain place, like late elementary, and she starts to develop more, it's a little anxiety provoking for you because you're like, oh, she's not a baby anymore, she's a woman, what do I do with her? This is the time she needs you the most. You lay the relational context from which she will see other relationships with men. And so if you do this well, if you teach her that her worth is far more than gold and silver, then she will expect that with the man who she dates, okay? And you tell her about that. I walked into a conversation this week as I was just walking through the living room where my husband was saying, Emerson, you know that you should be treated a certain way. And she's like, uh-huh. And he goes, you should be treated right. So you never, ever allow anyone to touch you in a way or hurt you or a guy to tell you you're not beautiful and you're not valuable and you're not God's creation. And he's just not worth your time if he does that. So it's those kind of conversations, guys, that are so important for your girls. And you start young and you continue throughout adolescence and into young adulthood. Okay. Boundaries. So one of the things with this age too is the opportunity for activities is going to increase exponentially. Okay, you can have your kid in everything, and you can have them in an activity every night of the week. Now, some kids, there's a great quote, I think by Kevin Lehman. He says, we all have 24 hours in the day, but we are not all created with the same capacity. And what that means is, yes, we all have 24 hours to spend, but some of us have more emotional capacity and some of us have less, and that tends to ebb and flow with the stages of your life, okay? And so I think about, like I said, I'm an introvert, so I have to really guard my time in that way so I don't freak out and say really bad words all the time to people. But also, with different periods of time, when we've had a child, you can anticipate that the birth of a child is gonna make you extra, extra tired, and you're not gonna have as much increased activity. If you have a daughter who is really, really into academics, and you can foresee that there's a time that she's gonna be really busy academically, then maybe she needs to pull back in other ways. If you will help her set up these boundaries and help her understand her emotional bent and her capacity, then you are setting her up for success later on in life because she'll have a better self-understanding of what she can handle. So if you can talk about these things. Okay, so for our family, this is what's part of our boundary system. What activity do you choose to do? And one thing I'll say, if it's not good for the whole family, for the whole family system, it's probably not very good for your girl. And what I mean by that is sometimes the family system will be sacrificed on the altar of making a child great. Okay, so they're already great, okay? You don't have to make them great. But also, if your whole family system is crumbling and she's for her to do something, that's not a good thing because the family system directly impacts her well-being. And so if it's not healthy and it's not doing well, she will not be doing well, even if you're doing something for her. And so you need to examine what is good for us. Are we a high capacity family where we want to spend the whole weekend doing activities? That's great. No one can tell you what's right. You've got to figure that out for your family. You've got to decide what you're willing to do and what you're willing to sacrifice. Also, you as parents, your jobs influence what your kids can do. My husband and I both work outside the home, and that's a choice we've both made, and that influences what activities our kids can be in. But that's a choice that we are okay with. You guys may have more flexibility because of your family system, and that's okay. You just need to examine what's our capacity. And if it is running you ragged as mom or dad, you should stop, probably, because it's impacting how you relate to your kids. Okay, it's okay for your kid not to be in everything. There are probably only a handful of children in this room who are gifted enough to actually go on and play professional sports. I'm sorry to be the one that has to tell you that. Okay? There are a few. So just remember, it is so much better to save the family system than rather try to make the world revolve around her. Okay? We know we have, we're not very athletically inclined. I mean, he is, but sorry. I didn't mean to. He's very athletically inclined. I just go to the gym, okay? He really is. He ran 11 miles yesterday. But we have small children because we're short. They're not going to be star athletes. And so we take that into account when we make choices because we want to protect our family system and we want to protect what's most important to us, okay? Modesty. We are far more overly sexualized now. And if you think about, right now is a great time if you just go like, some of you are doing this because you're buying Halloween costumes for your kids. When I was a kid, elementary girls were still like Raggedy Ann and, you know, kind of frumpy things. Now, it's like the sexy Dallas Cowboy cheerleader. And I'm like, wow, I didn't know that could be so high cut and so low cut. Are those panties? Like, I don't think those are actually shorts. Okay, you're gonna have to protect her because the culture is not going to. Everything is overly sexualized. And so you are probably gonna be the parent that nobody likes in your house, okay? That's okay. They'll grow out of it, and even if they don't, it was far better than being liked. I had one of mine said this week, I just don't like you anymore. I'm like, that's okay. I've worked on that in therapy. I'm secure in my self-concept. I don't need you to like me. I have friends. You're not my friend. And I'm an introvert, so I don't need a whole lot of friends. That's fine. I'm okay with that. And so it's better for them now. If we allow them to be overly sexualized, that's being part of the culture, it will be far worse for their development because it teaches them that you're an object. You're an object to be looked at. You're for someone else's pleasure and enjoyment. And that is not what I want my girl growing up thinking. She's not. She's not an object. She's a person. She's an image bearer. Okay? So you're going to be very uncool. So prepare your heart. We could do like a support group for that. Moms usually struggle the most with it. Dads are like, whatever, I don't care. Moms, we can have a support group for not being liked. Okay, talking about sex. Again, talk about it, talk about it, talk about it. Be the parent who will talk about the inappropriate, awkward, uncomfortable things so that she knows she can come to you. Okay, and do it early. There's not one right age necessarily. There's some great guidelines and some books that give you some guidance here. I'll just tell you the age is keeps getting moved back and back and back because our culture is so overly sexualized. My husband taught fifth grade a decade ago, and he had a girl in his fifth grade class that was pregnant. Pregnant! Like, at 29, I was like, I'm not ready for this. And a fifth grader, that's like 11 or 12, okay? So the culture's just forcing us to talk about things much earlier and to be ahead of the curve. I don't want some 12-year-old kid telling my kid about the rules of it. I wanna be the one that gives her the details and the nitty gritty. So when I gave this talk last semester, we hadn't had the sex talk yet with Emerson. But last week, 5 minutes before bed, where do babies come from? How does a baby get inside the tummy? It's like, we will cover that first thing tomorrow morning because I don't have the bandwidth to cover that at 8. But she's 5. 5. I want you to think about when you did or did not have the sex talk with your parents. It probably wasn't at 5. Our world is just changing. And so we've got to be prepared to prepare them well. Okay? At this age, again, the self-worth comes from dad. You teach her self-worth. You tell her how important she is and how valuable she is. And you demonstrate that by how you treat her mom. So if you treat her mom like she is worth far more valuable than gold and silver, she will internalize that and say, that's how men treat women. That's how I should demand. That sounds a little, not demand. I don't want to make divas. But that's the standard I should expect, is that men are going to treat me right, okay? And then technology. Again, this is a huge thing. And I can't tell you when the right time is to give your daughter a cell phone. There's a great book called Tough Guys and Drama Queens, and he gives the explanation somewhere between 5 and 95. So good luck with that. It's all dependent upon her maturity, your life circumstances. She may really need to get a hold of you. And so circumstantially, she may need to have a cell phone. But you need to just put up good boundaries around this. They don't know how to set boundaries. You've got to be the one that does it. And then by you doing it, you teach them things. So two things that I am really big on. They don't go to sleep with their cell phone. Reason being, one, you don't know what they're being exposed to, but two, we're seeing lots and lots of research about how much it negatively impacts sleep patterns. And during this period of time, especially ramping up into adolescence, kids need a lot of sleep. Adults, we need more sleep, but kids need a lot. And so if they're looking at their devices, it's keeping them awake, okay? And it's also kind of like sleeping with the enemy. Because you don't know, she's probably far smarter than you technologically than you are actually. And that's not that I'm saying you're stupid. Kids are just far more advanced. They pick it up easier, And so you've got to stay ahead of the curve, and that's one way you can do it, is it gets turned in. This week at DTS, our whole chapel series was about a theology of technology. And if that interests you, you can go on the DTS website and watch those chapel podcasts. But he was talking about how they did a study recently about how cell phones impact a sense of vulnerability and connection. And one of the things they found was just the presence of a cell phone sitting out on a coffee table, and the people that were in the experiment, it wasn't their cell phone even. That impacted their level of safety and security and connection. And then when they took the cell phone away, people walked away and were like, I feel really connected. That was great for me. And it was a perfect stranger they talked to. And so that was just another reminder to me of how important it is that in our home, we have times that are technology free. I thought it was okay to have a cell phone sitting on our dinner table, even if we weren't using it. Now I know, okay, we got to put it somewhere in the house if we're going to do dinner together. So, independence. You increase their responsibilities in an age-appropriate manner. And again, this is kind of on a continuum. Sometimes you have kids that are just born and they're like 30. My sister's like that. I'm the baby, so I'm super, super irresponsible. But she was like born knowing how to balance a checkbook. I don't know. Like, how do you know how to do this stuff? She's like, I don't know. So sometimes you have a kid that can handle far more than your other children, and that's okay. Increase their responsibilities as they're ready with their maturity level, but give them increasing responsibilities. Again, the goal is that they leave. They go. Get out of here, okay? Also, this can involve discipline and punishment. One of the things I do when I work with families of late elementary and older, and usually I get several different types of clients. One, they're behaving inappropriately. Two, they're super depressed, and so forth. But with the behaving inappropriately, one of the things I do is I don't want only the parent to decide the discipline techniques. I want the kid to be part of it. And so we all sit down together and we contract for stuff. What this does is it gives the kid buy-in, so they know, oh, if I do this, I'm gonna lose screen time for a week. That's not worth it to me. Also, it helps take the pressure out for you as a parent. Because in the moment when you're trying to take on, you're trying to discipline, it's like, you're grounded for a year, and it just never goes well. And then you have to backtrack, and then, So involve them in that and say, you know, here are our family rules. Here's where you've kind of been struggling. These are your growth areas. What do you think is an appropriate consequence if you choose to be sassy with your mouth, or if you choose to steal, whatever it is your kid's dealing with? And then let them be a part of that. Usually kids far overshoot appropriate consequences. They'll say, I should lose the car for a year. And then as a parent, it's like, no, that's not a good consequence. That's like, okay, I'm punished. I choose no consequences that directly impact me. But let them have some buy-in in that, okay? So I've given you a list of resources. Not all of them are religious resources, but they're not gonna tell you anything that's gonna directly contradict Jesus and the Bible, okay? I wanna add one more resource that I forgot to put on there, and it is, I'll let you get to a place where you can write. It's called A Therapist's Guide to Child Development. A Therapist's Guide to Child Development. : The Extraordinarily Normal Years. It was written by a woman named Dee Ray, and she's actually up at North Texas. And she was telling me the reason she wrote this book. She said before she had kids, she read everything there was. And especially she really liked What to Expect When You're Expecting, and then What to Expect During the First, I don't know how far they go up. I didn't do any reading. I was like, we'll wing it, it's fine. we'll figure this out as it happens. But she said that it stopped after like the first year or two, and she really, really loved that. Like, it just helped her know what was coming. And so she wrote this book with that concept in mind. And so, as you can tell from the title, it says therapists, so most of the time therapists are gonna buy this. But it is a really, really helpful guide, and I would recommend parents have it too. And what they've done is they go year by year, they give you a good foundation of what development looks like, and then they go year by year of what to expect physically, emotionally, socially, and cognitively. And then they tell you when to seek help. That's like the most important part of it is like, okay, when do I go to a therapist? Okay. Usually what it does, and development is just a guideline. There is a wide berth of what is normal. Also, you may have a kid, it happens a lot, where sometimes kids just get a little out of step with development. It's not a huge deal. They're just maybe a little behind or maybe a little ahead. It's not necessarily the time to freak out and go to the doctor. Sometimes you just need to wait and see if they catch up, because sometimes they will catch up, okay? But this book helps give you a guideline of this is what is normal, this is what this looks like, okay? And the rest of the references, I've tried to break them up into categories of what it really covers, so that if you're looking for relational development or strong-willed children, discipline, brain development, it kind of gives you a guideline for that. So we have about 10 minutes left. I'm going to open it up for any questions you may have. Yes?
So I have a question about character development. I mean, you were talking to your early on in the years about being able to think concretely versus abstractly. Mm-hmm. So when you look at kind of that age of salvation, so at what age do you kind of see where kids are going to accept Christ, accept salvation, and really understand what that means?
Mm.
I know some young kids, you know, pray the prayer and you know, maybe they've heard it all along. I know my daughter, for example, she talks about Jesus, talks about God, but I know that she's not really ready, because I don't really think that she understands what that means. And so I don't want to push her. I want it to be led by her.
Right. Well, I think one thing is you're on target with, you always want it to be led by the child. And sometimes as parents, I get really anxious, because I'm like, well, what's going to happen if she dies? And so I think you just said it, you let it be child-led. I know here there's a standard of when kids can go through the baptism classes, and the baptism service is third grade, because they have more of a readiness to understand that. I think there's a big trust factor that goes into the salvation piece. Because right now, I think our daughter is a Christian, but I don't know for sure. And I just have to continue. I mean, I guess I'll never know for sure, actually. But I do believe that we see fruit in her life, and she's saying the right things. But I also know, too, spiritual development, it's an unfolding. And it developmentally, she will know more and understand more as she gets older. And so I can't necessarily say there's these markers that definitively say, yes, she trusted Christ and she understands. I think that will unfold as they get older, and you will see very childlike faith, which is good. It's what the Bible tells us to have until that point. But I think a big part of it is, like you said, you allow them to be leading. And when they go to that place and they say, I want to trust Jesus, you say, I would love for you to. Let me walk beside you in that. Yeah. Dave has a great saying where if you asked a kid that's pretty young to ask a fire truck into their heart, they would totally be like, I'm in. Will would totally be for that. Salvation through fire trucks. Yeah. No, good question. Other questions? Yeah.
My husband and I are both from families of all boys, and we mm-hmm. have two daughters, and really so overwhelmed with the idea of, well, we're surrounded by girls, because we've all been surrounded by boys for and the idea of a daddy-daughter date, and my girls are like, mm-hmm.
I think I'd let her decide. Just ask her, is there something you want to go do with me? Well, Dad, ask her, is there something you'd like to go do with me? And maybe he can always have in the back of his mind, this is our backup plan, and we'll go to dinner or whatever. But ask her, what do you want to go do? And that shows her you're really interested, and it's, who doesn't want someone to go do what they like with them and give them undivided attention during that time? One of the things that my husband has done, the musical concerts they do here, our daughter loves music. That's a great opportunity to do a date. And it's kind of paint by number. You just show up. You don't have to talk that much. So, but I would ask her, what do you want to go do? And you may have a more athletically inclined girl, and so maybe she wants to go kick the soccer ball. And then you have a girl that's like, I want to go get a pedicure. guys get pedicures. It's okay for your feet to look nice. It's actually a gift you give to your wife. Okay? Athlete's foot is not a gift. It is a gift that keeps on giving. But so just to ask. But my go-to is always pedicures with my daughter because I directly benefit as well. But she loves it. I'm like, let's go get a pedicure. Good question. Yeah.
Can you speak at all to maybe the single mom or a wife that doesn't have an active husband or the stepfather-father issue and how that plays into self-worth and so on?
That's a great question. So as a single mom, one of the things, because I've worked with several single moms in private practice, and one of the things I've encouraged is if there's not a stepdad present, find a good godly man in your church who you know is safe and invite him to have some influence into her world. Okay, so that's one way. The next one is with stepdads, they're great. Interestingly enough, we on the way here, I love that song by Kelly Clarkson. I don't know what the title is, but it's she's talking about her dad who left and then her stepdad who came right in. And so I think stepdads can come right in and cautiously and slowly begin to play the role of dad based on the feedback they get from the daughter. So if the daughter's really receptive to it, I say go full steam ahead. If the daughter's more reticent, then kind of slowly, and usually if there's multiple girls in the house, you kind of have to, some are at different paces. But I think they can play just as equally an important role as birth father as well. It kind of depends on the leaving, and it depends on what the kid internalizes with the leaving. So because children will, if there's question marks, they will fill those question marks in with whatever comes to their brain. And so one thing that does tend to happen with divorce is that kids tend to internalize this, that it's my fault. And so I think a good question to always ask children in that situation is, why do you think dad's not here? Tell me kind of what that feels like, what you think about that, and then you can clear up any misconceptions. And as they get older, I think we have an unfolding understanding of what our context is, in the sense that if you have some sort of something that I would say is a tragedy, you get an increasing understanding. And so I think that's a continuing conversation, that there may be a point where a daughter might say, How could he have left? Or how did this happen? Or whatever the circumstances are. And you can talk more freely. But I think one of the outcomes can be that kids feel like they got left. And they chose something above them. And sometimes as a parent, especially a single parent, you may know that's true. And you have to do your best judgment of when you actually have that conversation with the kid of, they were having a hard time and this is what the choice was. People make poor choices, but it doesn't mean they love you less. I know it hurts a lot. Does that kind of help? Yeah. So that's a really hard one. But I think stepdads who do come into the situation can have a huge, huge role in the life of a daughter and fill a great need.
First of all, very well done, and thank you for doing this. Back to independence and choice giving, building an internal locus of control. Can you give an example?
Yes. So, like with a little bitty kid, and kids, if you think about the neurons that I talked about, self-control follows that same principle, that you've got to have enough experiences that form a rut in the brain that it's more likely that those neurons will fire in the same path. So think, they say it takes 21 days to make a pattern. It's kind of like that. It takes over and over and over again for you to be your default switch. So kids are not very self-controlled because of that. Their brains just don't have enough, they haven't had enough time to be as self-controlling. And so with an internal locus control, you might say something like, Emerson, if you choose to take your plate to the trash, you choose to have dessert. Actually, I don't want to reward with food. That's a whole other issue. But if you choose to take your plate to the trash, you choose to have screen time after dinner. And the idea is, it's if you choose this, then you choose this. And as a parent, there is a clear thing that I want her to do. I mean, I clearly want her to be obedient to me and take her food to the trash, but I'm going to give her the opportunity to decide and do what we call bring herself under control. And whatever she decides is fine. There's just a consequence to whatever that decision is.
Yeah, good choices, good consequences.
Yes. And usually what we tell kids is, don't do that. Stop it. Take your plate to the trash. So giving them that opportunity to, this is your choice. If you choose not to do it, I will do it, but you will also choose no screen time.
Then I think I got it with the same question about examples for the naming emotions. I got the making amends part, the naming emotions. Some mm-hmm. examples.
Yes, so like, and you guys think I have little bitty kids. So when my son gets mad at me or my daughter gets mad, I say something like, you're really angry with me right now. You feel really hurt. In counseling, we call that reflecting feelings. And what it does is it demonstrates empathy and it says, I see you. That's that part of the attachment thing. And so if you can just label that for them and say, you feel really mad right now. You feel really sad. And sometimes it's like in the little bitties, it may be in the context of a fit. As they get into preschool and elementary school, it may be more in the context of them telling you about their day, because at that point, they don't spend the majority of their time with you anyways. So they get in the car after school and you can tell there's something going on. And you say, it seems like you're sad today, or you seem different today. Tell me what's going on. And she said, well, so-and-so was mean to me at recess. That really hurt your feelings. You feel really sad. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if you have really emotional children in the moment and uh-huh. it's not really where you can have a dialogue with them at that time.
Right.
Is it just as effective to reflect those feelings afterward once they've calmed down and kind of entered that rational thought, or do you feel like mm-hmm. saying it then, it's kind of going into their brain mm-hmm. and then kind of rehash it once they're calm?
That's a great question. So we don't want you to do anything when they are when someone is above a 3 emotionally, they're not processing any dialogue or information. And so in that moment when they are unraveling, you just stay with them. You're really sad. And you may have to set limits. I know you're really angry, but I'm not for hitting. And you just stay right there with them. With some kids, you have to remove them from the situation. And if they're little, that's great, because you just pick them up and go. Then later you can come back and say, you were really mad. Can you tell me more about what happened? I want to remind you that you were really angry, and anger is okay, but I'm not for throat punching or whatever. So hopefully that's not happening. All right, well, we're out of time. So